Hey everyone, thanks very much for coming. Hope everyone can grab a seat. There's chairs in the back if anyone doesn't have a seat. All right, so you are at the SACFON campus session for today. My name is Jen Prosser. I'll be your moderator for the session. Can everyone hear me okay? It's a fairly small room, so there shouldn't be any problems. So just a bit of a background on SACFA. SACFA is a volunteer nonprofit organization and relies on the contributions of members and session attendees, such as yourselves, to continue its work. And we'd like very much to acknowledge our partners, the University of Lethbridge, as well as the University of Lethbridge Students Union and Lethbridge Public Interest Research Group. So like all SACFA sessions, today the format of the meeting will be a 30-minute presentation from our presenter, Mike Kudema, as well as a 25-minute break for snacks, followed by a 30-minute question period. And our presentation today is on why direct action. Direct action is a form of resistance that aims to derail offensive practices to create more favorable ones using immediately available means. Such actions include boycotts, strikes, sit-ins, letter-writing, campaigns, protests, and sabotage. Direct action sometimes involves civil disobedience. The uprising against the World Trade Organization in Seattle, Washington, November 1999, was the most visible and dramatic protest in the United States since the Vietnam War. It catapulted the concept of direct action and resistance to the North American mainstream psyche, although direct actions and their participants have been around since societies were developed. The historically innovative tactics of environmentalists, suffragists, and nuclear freeze advocates have resulted in a present-day thriving culture of creative forms of resistance. Mike Kudema, climate and energy campaigner with Greenpeace Canada, will discuss the role of direct action in bringing about social change. He will take us through the decades of experience working in Alberta and make the case that direct action is often necessary for progressive change. He's been a long-time dedicated and creative activist in Edmonton, Alberta, primarily. He has participated in countless direct actions, the most high-profile of which have included actions to the streets of Quebec City for the FTAA protests, sleeping on the steps of the Alberta Ledge to protest rising tuition rates, and occupying Deputy Prime Minister Anne McLennan's office to defeat Canada's anti-terrorism legislation. Mike Kudema gained his Bachelor of Education, majoring in drama, and most recently his law degree, specializing in labor and environmental law. He's also the author of An Action a Day Keeps Global Capitalism Away, published by Between the Lines Press. He currently works for Greenpeace Canada and is fighting to stop the Athabasca tar sand. He's also a climb trainer with Ruckus Society and has held activist training camps, such as the one that will be after this meeting tonight at 7 if you're interested in joining, and teaches inspiring activist skills ranging from climbing to blockades. So I'd like you guys all to welcome Mike to the podium.
Cool. I wanted to thank you all for bringing me out here. It's definitely a super big treat in terms of coming down to Lethbridge. I was originally born in Medicine Hat, so I'm from at least southern Alberta, and so it's nice to sort of come back at least a little bit closer to home. Today for the presentation, it's basically going to mostly be just sharing stories with you all of some of the stuff that we've done that sort of highlights some of the different, you know, techniques that you can go about sort of bringing about direct action. We're going to start with the presentation in terms of like just looking at the present day situation, talking a little bit about that, talking a little in terms of why, you know, we might want to engage in direct action and what it is, and then just go into some fun stories that I'm hoping that you'll all enjoy. So that's sort of the process in terms of what we're going to try and get through in the next 30 minutes. It's going to go pretty fast because I want to talk about a lot of different things, but yeah, hopefully you enjoy the ride. So I always start with songs, so hopefully none of you will get too nervous with this. But theater is such a big component in terms of the stuff that I do, and I think, you know, the stuff that we need to do, especially when we have small groups of people. Theater is just, you know, this amazing thing that we can do to bring about social change with very small groups of people that's really engaging and fun for us to do, and really engaging and fun for people to watch. And so I like to try and start every presentation that I do with some type of interactive song, because, you know, most of it is just going to be me talking up here, so I like to get you all sort of involved right from the bat. So this is the Anarchist ABCs. It comes from a group of anarchists in New York City that I met in Quebec City, and it basically goes to the tune of the ABC song, which I think everybody here should know. Everybody knows the ABC song? Yeah? Okay. So we're all going to sing together, so that I don't look like an idiot singing by myself. So we're all going to sing, collectively, the Anarchist ABCs. Does it sound okay? Okay. So you ready to start? OECDMAI APECNAFTA WTOGATS WBMESPP. Now I know my enemies. Won't you smash the state with me? Yeah. So those are the Anarchist ABCs. I encourage you all to teach your children so they know both versions. But yeah, there they are. So I wanted to start just sort of giving a brief snapshot in terms of some of the stuff that we're up against right now. So every year, 50,000 species disappear from our planet. That's 6 species every single hour. 25,000 people die every day of hunger, which is 17 people every minute. We lose 24 hectares of forest every single minute of every single day. The richest 10% own 85% of the total assets globally. The bottom half of the planet combined only own 1% of the planet's wealth. So, it's not a very good place. And it's, you know, just reading those stats like every single time, you know, I think a lot of times already I feel myself getting a little bit overwhelmed just looking at some of those stats and being like, holy fuck, you know. That makes me want to, like, go hide under my covers and, like, just pretend that the world's okay. But it's a big problem. And I think direct action is sort of one pathway in terms of, like, feeling empowered about being able to do something about it. But before we get there, we're going to continue down the rabbit hole in terms of how bad things are. So climate change, the game changer. 15 to 37% of plant and animal species will be wiped out globally by 2050 by global warming alone. Due to climate change, 3.2 billion people will be suffering from water scarcity problems by 2080, and 600 million more people will go hungry. We will see more hurricanes, droughts, forest fires, and other extreme weather events, and millions of climate refugees will be created. Climate change is one of the main issues that I work on right now. And I work on it mainly because about 3 years ago I had an opportunity to travel around the world with a group of people that were directly impacted by the effects of climate change right now. One of the people was a guy named Ben Namakin, who came from this small island nation called Tuvalu, which is a small island nation in the middle of Micronesia. The highest point in that island is 15 feet above sea level. And every year, 5 years ago, his island broke in half due to sea level rising. 2 years ago, he had to dig up his relatives who were buried and move them to the highest point in the island because sea levels continued to rise on his island. He knows that his island is going to go underwater. Every year, they evacuate the maximum number of people allowable to New Zealand to evacuate themselves. So when we talk about climate change, and you know, you hear it all the time, and it's just sort of this thing that's out there, you know, the immediacy to act is urgent. We need to act on climate change now because the impacts on humans, on plants, and animals are already happening, and they're going to get worse every single year that we delay action. And so that's another sort of thing that we need to sort of hold in our belly and, you know, feel that and really feel the urgency to speak of. And I think when we get to start talking about direct action, one of the reasons why I think we need it is really because we need action that, you know, speaks to the urgency of the situation that we're facing. Like, all the stats that you just saw in the last two pages are happening all the time. Like, the number of people that die of hunger every single minute. We need, you know, sometimes petition drives, which are great and got to be a part of what we do, don't speak to the, you know, the immediacy of the fact that this is the number of people that are dying every single hour. And so we need for our actions to sort of convey that type of urgency as well. So let's look a little bit locally in terms of what we're up against. I work in the tar sands, which is, you know, to me, one of the biggest David and Goliath struggles on the face of the planet. So we're just going to go quickly through, you know, what we're facing here in Alberta in the tar sands. But this can apply to any energy project that's in Alberta or a whole host of other issues that we're facing here. Tar sands are the world's largest industrial and capital project on the planet. supplies the world's largest economy. 70% of the oil is going straight across the border to the U.S., so it's not for Canadian need. That's just a few of the companies that are involved, so it's a whole who's who of international oil companies. Exxon last year made over $86 billion in gross profits. And then we've had one-party rule since 1971, so it's 37 years of the exact same government. We have a premier currently that has said that he refuses to touch the brakes when it comes to tar sands development. We have an environment minister. But, you know, you think, you know, if your title was environment minister, you'd stick up for the environment every once in a while. But this is his quote. The market should decide the pace of tar sands development. Nothing else. Government shouldn't be involved. And then more specifically on the tar sands, so by 2015, they're going to emit more greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere than all the cars and trucks in Canada combined. So just picture that. Picture all the cars and trucks on the road today that you've ever seen. Capture all of, like, the emissions that they emit and bottle that, and that's how much we're going to be emitting in the Alberta just from the tar sands. That's a crazy, crazy amount. Every day they create 1.8 million liters of toxic tailings, which is a whole host of dangerous chemicals that are linked to a whole host of nasty stuff that we can get into if we want. The area available for leasing is an area the size of the state of Florida. It's actually 23% of our province is what's available for leasing for tar sands development, 149,000 square kilometers. So we're talking about a huge, massive area. Could be killing people downstream. More and more people in First Nation communities are being diagnosed with very rare forms of cancer. Are seeing members of their community die, and they believe that the reason is because the tailing lakes are leaching into the Athabasca River and are contaminating their water supply. And so every day they have to question whether their water is safe to drink. And, you know, I don't think anybody in Alberta should be questioning the safety of their own water supply. And by 2015, the tar sands will use enough natural gas to heat half the homes in Canada. So instead of heating half of the homes in Canada, we're going to be extracting some of the most dangerous fuel on the face of the planet. So that's what we're up against. So, you know, when you read that, you really want to go home and, like, hide under your covers and be like, okay, I'm done. But that's the exciting thing is, you know, it really is a David and Goliath struggle in terms of, like, these problems are so large. But the solution in terms of, like, how we feel good about it is by getting engaged, is by getting active in terms of working towards a solution. And not only are we, you know, we facing all of this destruction, but it's also this tremendous opportunity. We're at one of the greatest crises that this planet has ever been on. And we have a pathway where we can, you know, have an actual solution. But when we're talking about, you know, we're facing an economic crisis, we're facing a climate crisis, we're facing a food crisis, all three of them, in my opinion at least, are solved by building a green energy economy here in this country and all around the planet. You're talking about, you know, then we no longer become dependent on what the price of oil is. And so we don't, because solar and wind, you know, we control that. It's community fed. We know the price of that. You're talking about jobs. In this province alone, solar and wind energy could bring 200,000 jobs to this province alone. You're talking about jobs that can't be shipped to other countries because nobody but people working in Alberta are going to be putting solar panels on your roofs. You're talking about, you know, saving and protecting agricultural land rather than giving it up to development. So you're talking about protecting local food supplies and local energy. You're talking about building communities because everything is going to need to shrink inwards. And so we're going to become closer together and learn about how to work together as a community. Like, all that stuff to me is just fundamentally exciting. And we're at that point. We're at the point where we can choose what path that we go on. Do we go down this dangerous path of dirty fuels like the tar sands that really is going to mean the end of our planet? Or do we, you know, are we a part of bringing about that energy revolution that saves it all? And we're at that defining moment. We're at, you know, our civil rights movement is now. And that's sort of what motivates me when I, you know, start engaging in this work, is that we are at that apex, and we control what direction we go in. So why direct action, though? Well, this is some of the stuff that we've just done on the tar sands campaign. And by sort of putting this list here, I'm not trying to say that any of these tactics are not important, we shouldn't engage in them, but just trying to look at all the different things that we've done, and we still haven't got very much change. And so, you know, that's why I think we need some new tactics as well. The two that I really want to sort of pick out of here are, number one, public forums. One of the things that Stelmach did when he first came into power is held forums right across the province asking Albertans, what do you want when it comes to the tar sands? And overwhelmingly, people were like, well, we think the development's going too fast. We can't keep up with infrastructure. We're seeing, you know, changes in our community. We're hearing about all this environmental damage. It's going too fast. Let's slow it down. And the government the next day, that's when Stelmach said his famous line, well, when it comes to the tar sands, we're not touching the brake. And so even though the majority of Albertans wanted this thing slowed down, the government said no. Same with government consultations. You have all these consultation bodies that, you know, environmentalists are a part of, First Nation groups are a part of, and they're starting to pull out. And they're saying there's no point with us being in these bodies anymore because at the end of the day, the government does what it wants, and what the government wants is whatever industry wants. And so these are some of the things that we need to change. So when these things aren't working, I think that we need to start using some old tactics. So what do I mean by old tactics? Well, direct action is a pretty old tactic. So what's direct action? Well, it's political action that happens outside normal political channels. It's direct, so you're not seeking an intermediary, so I wouldn't go to my MLA and say, you know, this is the change that I want. And I just go and try and bring about that change myself. It seeks to bring immediate relief, directly change a situation, or create a situation that necessitates action or change. And it's both sort of, it can be used to stop something, and so it, you know, has this connotation in terms of stopping the rates of destruction, but it can also be used to create something. And so we're going to get into a couple examples of, you know, where direct action can be used about creating that system that we want to move to. So why do we do direct action? There's a whole host of reasons in terms of why you would engage in direct action. Sometimes direct action is just a one-off. I think direct action is best used when it's part of a longer-term campaign and when you're using it at key moments within that campaign to bring about change. So you're doing all those other things that we just showed in the last page to, you know, because if you can get the change that you want through normal government channels, that's great. But if you can't, we need to start thinking outside the box and start trying some different tactics. So these are just some of them. I think some of the most important ones on here are escalation and really making sure that, you know, each stage of our action, we're applying more and more pressure on whoever we're targeting to try and bring about the change that we want. The other one that I would mention is fun. I think direct action is fun to do. And I don't think that reason should be, you know, discounted because, you know, you saw the four pages of issues that we're working on. Those are pretty heavy issues. And so to make the work that we do fun and engaging and be able to laugh and be able to feel good about it at the end of the day is important so that we don't burn out, so that we feel good about the work that we're going to do because it's going to be a long process. And we need everybody to be along for that ride. And so fun is a good point. So I want to move now just in terms of like looking at some of the history, because I think in Alberta people are like, well, direct action doesn't work in Alberta. You know, you can't use direct action to bring about social change. So I thought it was important really quickly just to look at, you know, the fact, well, let's look at all the major rights that we've had and whether direct action was a part of each and every one of them. So the first one is worker rights, you know, the 8-hour work day, the 40-hour work week, working conditions, all that. Direct action was a part of that. Strikes were a part of that. Walkouts were a part of that. The Winnipeg General Strike is one of the best examples. 35,000 workers marching off the job. 1 million workers in the States that walked off the job to demand better working conditions that we now enjoy today. And we have those because of direct action. Women's suffragist movement, exact same thing. Part of this, you know, involved women chaining themselves to railings and saying, we're not going to move until we have the right to vote. It involved them going on hunger strikes or sit-ins of official offices. Even, you know, getting directly in front of political politicians and saying, I'm not going to move. You can run over me. And in fact, one woman was run over until you recognize that we're people. And so the fact that women can vote now, part of that was because of direct action as well. Indian independence. Another great example of, you know, the liberation of a nation was, you know, a nonviolent direct action movement where, you know, Gandhi got up and said, we're going to make our own salt. And it was a very symbolic action, but it was a direct action. He said, we're not going to wait for the British to give us the power to do this. We're going to walk to the ocean. We're going to do it ourselves. We're going to put our bodies on the line to do it. Civil rights movement, another great example. This is, you know, a quote from Martin Luther King. We who engage in nonviolent direct action are not the creator's attention. We merely bring to the surface the hidden tension that's already alive. That's a picture of Rosa Parks. I think the one thing about Rosa Parks is that she didn't decide one day just to, like, move to the front of the bus. That was something that was coordinated for months and months and months. And people were doing it all over as part of a coordinated civil disobedience campaign to put Rosa Parks in that exact situation. And she's been glorified, but it was, you know, a strategic choice. It was part of an ongoing campaign to put her in that position to bring about civil rights in America. Apartheid movement, same thing. The methods employed by anti-apartheid activists in the 1980s amounted to the largest grassroots eruption of diverse nonviolent direct action strategies in a single struggle in human history. More recently, the WTO. Over 100,000 people came from all over the world to Seattle to shut down the WTO, and they did. They collapsed the round in Seattle. The WTO has not had a successful round since, and I'm betting that within the next 5 years the WTO will collapse completely. And I think that's because of people, citizens all around the world saying, you know, no to the WTO, no to this government body that's going to tell us what we're going to do. Here in Canada, one of the best examples that we have is the Great Bear Rainforest or Clayquot Sound. Millions of acres of rainforest were protected because people, just like everybody sitting in this audience, went to Clayquot Sound and said, no, this forest is too important. It's hundreds of years old. You know, the ecosystem that's here is too important to this planet for you to chop it down. And you can't. And I'm going to stay here, and I'm going to come and get arrested today. And tomorrow my friend's going to come and get arrested. And tomorrow somebody else is going to come. And that's the way that they did it, until eventually the BC government said, okay, well, we can't keep dealing with this. And so sat down and actually negotiated to protect, you know, 1.1 million hectares of Great Bear Rainforest. And then Clayquot Sound as well. And Clayquot might actually be another fight that we have to go through. So coming back to Alberta. So how do we have fun and kick some ass in the belly of the beast? And this picture is actually, I typed in belly of the beast into Google Images, and that's the picture that came up. So I was like, okay, that's kind of Alberta-esque, I guess. About the belly of the beast. So let's start there. So how do we have some fun doing this, but still, you know, get some of our demands met? And so I wanted to go through just some quick stories in terms of some of the stuff that we've done in the province or that other groups have done around the world that, you know, that we can do really easily. So the first is, what can you get for $10.90? So this is one of the best things that you can do in terms of using the power that society already gives you. And that's with playing with uniforms. Society gives this weird power to anybody that's wearing a uniform. It's almost automatic obedience. And so there's this group in Waterloo that was running an anti-idling campaign, and they just wanted people to, you know, shut off their cars, not idle anymore. So they were getting nowhere. You know, they're trying to do all this education stuff, getting nowhere. So eventually what they decided to do is they decided to print up all these business cards, look very, very professional, dress up in safety vests, the whole, like, safety outfit, and every time they would see somebody idling, they would go up to them, knock on the window of their car, get them to roll it down, and be like, I'm sorry, I don't know if you know this, but you're in a no-idling zone. I need you to turn off your car immediately. Can you do that? And almost every single time, the person would be like, oh my God, I'm so sorry, I didn't even know. There should be signs up in there. And they would turn off their car. And they estimate that they've reduced idling on their campus by 60-80% just by doing this simple thing. They're not, you know, misrepresenting themselves because they have the business cards. They're just dressing up, looking a little more professional. We did this here in Alberta during the Liberal convention that happened a bunch of years ago when they were still in power. It was right after 9/11 happened, so Canada was trying to bring in all the security legislation that was really going to fundamentally change in terms of civil liberties in this country. And so there was two of us, and we're like, okay, the Liberal convention's in town, there's two of us, it's the night before, what do we do? And so we decided to go to Toys R Us. And we went to Toys R Us, which I don't necessarily recommend you shop at because, you know, most of it's from China and child labor. But we were desperate. And so we went there and we bought Secret Service agent kits. And approximate cost, probably about $6. Then we went to Valley Village and bought two very nice-looking suits for about $4, and decided we were going to be a Secret Service for that day for the convention. And we went in, we had the earpieces all in, we had, you know, the little badge, we had everything. Looked pretty professional. And went right into the convention, past everybody, and then stood on either side of the door as Secret Service agents. And we could see that there was other Secret Service agents in the room. And every time that they would check their little earpiece, we would check our little earpiece. And just pretend like we could all hear them. And be like, And so eventually delegates just start streaming in. And we're like, okay. Nothing happens. So we're like, well, you know, this is kind of lame. We want to make a little bit more of a point, so let's escalate this a little further. So we'd start saying things to people like, oh, go right on in, you know, the other terrorists are already inside. A little stuff like that. We get the occasional odd look, but still nobody questioned us at all. Then we decide to escalate it even more. And so we took three people, one of which was an MP, and frisked them for weapons of mass destruction. And we said, I'm sorry, sir, we're just doing routine inspections of everybody. I just need you to stand against the wall. If you can spread your arms and legs, we're checking everybody for weapons of mass destruction, and we'll only take a few minutes. I really apologize about this inconvenience. Everybody stood against the wall, spread eagled, and I was able to pat down an MP. Now, at that time is when, like, the real Secret Service actually realized we were not one of them and came over to us. And so, of course, at that point, we broke out of our little scene and, you know, made our statement to the media about civil liberties in Canada and how trusted it is. But uniforms are something that we can use because they already have power in our society. And just by putting one on, we take on a different persona and we're able to, you know, get all that power that society for some reason instills just because people have uniforms on. And so it's something that we can use. If you have more than two people, you can start your own organization. We started the Oil Enforcement Agency. This was something that we did in San Francisco, basically because President Bush, you know, in 2004 gave that speech of, you know, we must end America's oil addiction, we'll do everything we can to do it, and then proceeded to do nothing. And so we're like, well, you know, maybe we should get together and enforce that presidential mandate. That sounded pretty good, ending America's oil addiction. And so we started our own organization called the OEA, dressed up as police officers and would basically cordon off vehicles in auto shows. And so we go to, like, the LA Auto Show. We would police tape off a huge, like, Toyota Tundra or some, you know, big Hummer, tape it all off and stand there and keep people away because of, for safety reasons, of course. Be like, you know, this vehicle is just not safe. You know, you have no idea what it's going to do to you. Please keep back. And it was great. And whenever security would actually come over, we'd go, security would come over to us, and we'd hand security the caution tape, and we'd be like, we're so glad you're here. Thank you so much for coming. You know, this will be your jurisdiction now. We'll go someplace else, and we'd hand them the tape. And then they'd stand there very dumbly and, like, hold the tape up for us and carton off the vehicle as well. And even there was one instance where we were outside, and we were doing sort of these citizen surveys with people, and a police officer actually came up to one of our agents and was like, what are you doing? You need to get out of here. And our agent very coolly turned around and said, no, I don't think you understand. I'm with the OEA officer, and this is our jurisdiction, so why don't you go away? And the officer said, oh my God, I'm sorry. I didn't realize. And didn't bother him again. So, uniforms, big key. Political theater is another huge one in terms of, like, doing really amazing, catchy things with small groups of people is great. Also using sort of satire is a really fun thing to do in terms of just completely turning the tables on the debate. So this is an organization that we came up with called Billionaires for Tar Sands. This is around sort of the royalty debate where, you know, all these multi-billion dollar companies were complaining about how their profits might be cut. And so we're like, well, let's dress up as billionaires. We're going to have these absolutely stupid top hats spewing, you know, smoke at the top. And we would just go to, you know, conservative rallies or oil rallies and basically cheer for them really loud. And be like, oh, yes, increase our profits faster. Can we, you know, destroy the earth even more? Come on, please. And we'd cheer for them. And Stelmach would get up and we're like, oh, Stelmach's the best premium money can buy. And just say these, you know, things that really, you know, is really what they're saying, but in, like, such a, you know, over-the-top way that it sort of brings out how absolutely ludicrous what they're saying is. And so being able to sort of take that other side and just blow it up is another really great way to take some direct action. Deliveries are awesome. You can deliver absolutely anything. You make something up, you blow something up, and you can deliver it, and it's a media event, and it's a great way to, really put the heat on whoever you're targeting. This is one, again, during the royalty debate that we delivered to all the different oil companies in Calgary. It was basically boxes of 100% post-consumer Kleenex, and then these big sympathy notes, Dear Imperial, our sympathies are with you as you may learn that you won't make $83 billion in profits this year. And delivered them to them, and we're just like very tearful, and we're like, we're really sorry, It must be tough not to make $83 billion next year. But you can do that with absolutely anything, and it works with any issue. Tuition is a perfect example. I don't understand why any student would just pay their tuition in a normal way. And one of the things that we did at the U of A is, every single time that we pay our tuition, we're going to do it in a creative way that gets media attention that, shows that students shouldn't be paying this amount of tuition. So the first year we did it, we paid all our tuition in dimes and nickels. We got huge wheelbarrows of dimes and nickels, wheelbarrowed them up to the administration building and said, here's our tuition. Here's $5,000 of it. And it was great because, great media visual, gets great media attention, but it also, points out and actually physically shows how much money we're spending because there's such a disconnect. But when you see, $5,000 or $10,000 worth of dimes and nickels, you start to get the message. The next year we froze it in a gigantic block of ice because we wanted to freeze the fees. And so we're like, well, here's my tuition. It's in a block of ice, but it's all there. But think of all those type of things. Anything you can deliver, anything you can do sort of in a punchy way is a great way in terms of bringing light to issues that need to be brought to light. Counter-recruitment. This is something that we're starting to do on campuses in Alberta because all these different oil companies are recruiting on our campuses. And they're telling students a very one-sided view in terms of what it's like to work in Fort Mac and how beautiful and wonderful it is and how many programs that they have, but they don't tell people that Fort Mac has the highest suicide rate for men age 18 to 24, has a lack of social services, has one of the highest drug and alcohol and spousal abuse rates in the entire province. All that stuff is not told. And so we go to recruitment sessions, and sometimes we ask questions. In this particular one, we actually had somebody dress up as Satan, and at the end of Shell's presentation, she popped up, and we were like, okay, who wants to sign their soul? And they had this gigantic petition. But it's, again, sort of a way to, get the other side of the debate because companies are coming onto our campuses all the time. Naming rights are a huge issue on campuses, too, where, at the U of A, we have the Shell Canada Center, the Syncrude Center, we have the De Beers Diamond Lab. We need to start fighting back a little bit because universities are supposed to be a free space where we ask the big questions free from influence. And when companies start, coming onto your campus and recruiting or naming buildings, I think that starts to degrade it. This is another great thing, creative interruptions. This is one that we did during Ed Stelmach's speech. It was funny because his speech was actually on, he was launching a $25 million PR campaign to counter the efforts of Greenpeace and the Sierra Club because they were, talking badly about the tar sands. And it was funny because as soon as he mentioned Greenpeace, two of our activists descended from the ceiling and unleashed this banner. And we're able to, just turn all the press coverage. But I think the real point in this action is to really look for moments where, the press is already going to be there, where there's already a media story that that's going to happen, where, the person that you're trying to influence, the person who, can really make the decision in terms of what world you want, is already there, there's already press there, and how can you turn that so that the issue that you want is the issue that that people are talking about. This, of course, banner action takes some skill, takes some planning, takes a lot of money, but it doesn't have to be that complex. This is an action that we did in L.A. For the Los Angeles Auto Show. And basically, in Los Angeles Auto Show, the few days beforehand, they have, I think 3,000 auto journalists. I didn't even know there were 3,000 auto journalists on the planet. But apparently 3,000 auto journalists are in the room, and the CEO of General Motors was giving the keynote address. And so he gave the keynote address. It was in LA, so his speech was all about the environment, all about how GM is very concerned about climate change, how it gets climate change, is going to act and be, you know, a bold leader, all that type of stuff. Great speech, if he meant any of it. And so what we did is, because we knew that this was going to be the type of speech, there was just two of us, again, just dressed up in suits, managed to get inside. And so at the end of his speech, we walked on stage. And we did it in such a way that it looked like we were the person that was really supposed to be thanking him. And the person who was actually supposed to be thanking him, you know, actually looked at us because we were coming up on first and got a little confused and sort of backed off because he thought, oh, maybe he just got the program wrong and really these two people were next. And so we got up. My friend shook his hand and went right to the microphone and said, Rick, I just wanted to thank you for, you know, really showing leadership. It's so great to see, you know, an auto company showing leadership of this potential and to see a company really committing to act on climate change. We're even more glad that you're here today to put that commitment in writing. And my friend, and then this is my part, has this pledge for you to sign. And so we unveiled this pledge. It basically said, you know, that GM actually commits to doing everything that he just said in his speech and be, you know, a leader in fuel economy in the next 10 years. And then my friend passed Rick Wagner the marker and said, Rick, won't you do the honors and please sign the pledge? As if, you know, it was the next thing in the program. And the thing about it in terms of creative interruptions is you want to put people in a situation where it's a, you know, in a way it's a lose-lose situation for them. He can make it a, you know, so he has two options. Either one, he signs on to something and then makes his speech mean something, but it actually means he commits his company to actually doing something. Or number two, he says, no, I'm not going to sign it, and then looks like an ass in front of 3,000 reporters that just heard his speech about how climate change was the most important issue for his company. And of course, he chose the second path. His comment was, I think my speech spoke for itself, and then tried to push us off stage. But it unveiled to the audience, you know, that really his whole speech didn't mean anything. And we were able to do this action. All we did was basically wore two really fancy-looking suits and a little bit of Photoshop, and were able to do an action that got covered around the world. And so look for these opportunities, because they happen all the time. You know, people speak all the time where there's a media audience, and we can be there to change the debate, because people need to be talking about the issues that really matter. We need to be talking about climate change. We need to be talking about what's going on in our communities. And if people or politicians or anybody isn't, then let's find a way to make them. Next one. This is guerrilla gardening. I think this one is actually done in Edmonton, but I'm not sure. But this is sort of on the more positive end of, you know, or the more creative end of direct action, where, you know, it's really about there's not enough gardens in the city, so we're going to create our garden ourselves. And so this is, you know, a street installation that they did very creatively with sort of an oil drum and then that spilled out this beautiful garden. At the U of C, I'm told that the campus garden, actually the way that it was started, they tried to go through the administration and push for a campus garden for a long, long time. The administration wouldn't give it to them because brought up all these different concerns. And so one night in the dead of night, they just went in, ripped up the garden, or ripped up the earth, planted the garden, and the next day, there was so much support of it that the administration couldn't get rid of it. And that's why they have a campus garden now. And so it's got, you know, that creative aspect of it too. Another is installations. This, of course, is our lovely former premier, Ralph Klein. And so Greenpeace, this is a few years ago. One day, you know, Ralph Klein was a huge denier of climate change, you know, huge push against the Kyoto Protocol and signing on to the Kyoto Protocol. And so to really sort of, you know, crystallize that moment, direct action was used to really do that. And what Greenpeace did was installed solar panels on his roof. Went to his home and put up solar panels. Really hard for him to message out of, because, you know, who doesn't want solar panels on their roof? You know, it saves them the energy bill. It's great. And then became another big media story when he took the solar panels down from his roof. And so you get sort of a twofer out of this action, but really, you know, puts him in a very difficult situation, but the messaging is really beautiful for this action. This is another one. If you have more resources that we did off the High Level Bridge in terms of, you know, banner dropping, and really this one is about framing. And so this was done on the first day of the opening of the Alberta Legislature, and we basically said we need to start talking about tar sands in this province. This was a year ago, and we need to start doing it because the environmental devastation, the human rights devastation, are really unparalleled, and we need to start talking about it. And so we tried to set the agenda by dropping a couple of 40-foot banners off the high-level bridge and four climbers beneath them. Sit-ins, of course, are another super easy one to organize. This is the sit-in on the lunch counter that was used during the civil rights movement. This is one that we did at Anne McClellan's office with a twist. We started with the sit-in. We were able to negotiate for the whole week. And then a crazy idea came up really late at night when I think we were really too tired to really think it through. But people suggested getting a hot tub. And so we're like, okay, yeah, let's get a hot tub. And Anne McClellan's neighbor hates her, and so she actually provided all the power and water for the hot tub. And then we're like, okay, well, how do we message this? We don't want to just activists in the hot tub. That's kind of bad. And so the banner right across the front of it is, this legislation puts us all in hot water. It was all about the sort of terrorist legislation. And so just, you know, a creative way. And again, really having fun with doing it, but going right to her office and saying, we're going to sit in your office until you start listening to people and meet with us. We also demanded a mariachi band, but we never got that. Blockades is sort of another big one. This is from a group in South America, I believe. There's a bunch of different types. These are lockboxes from a Rising Tide group in Kentucky. This is a Earth First group in the Northwest, and I don't know if you can tell what this is, but this is what's called a sleeping dragon. And basically what you'll do is they drill a hole in the bottom of the car and then also in the road, and they put their arm through and there's a pin in the bottom, and so you basically are lying in the car, and in order to get you out they have to cut the car apart to get you out. So it's pretty dramatic. This is my favorite blockade. This is one in Tasmania that was done. And it's a tripod, and so this climber is actually sitting above three poles, and the poles are positioned in such a way that no cars can go by, and you can't really remove it, or else it sort of crashes down, and you could injure the person that's up there. But the reason why I like it so much is just because it's beautiful. Like, the mixture of art and activism within this is just, in my opinion, really, really breathtaking, because they really took it to another level. Like, to me, it looks like a painting, but it's, a really creative action. And then this direct interventions of going direct to the scene of the destruction or the scene of the crime and trying to stop it. And so this is an action that we did earlier this summer at Syncrete's Tailing Lake, where we erected two large banners and then tried to cap one of their pipes. And you can see, like, this is, you know, look at the size of that tailing lake. It's huge. It's 130 square kilometers is how much these tailing lakes currently exist. One tailing lake is 20 kilometers long and full of, like, toxic chemicals right beside the Athabasca River. That's another shot of it. Huge. So I'm nearing the end. So in the end, you know, if you don't believe this crazy guy from Greenpeace, this is a few other people. This is George Monbiot. He wrote Heat. He's a journalist from the UK, but Heat is one of sort of the big techs on global warming. And he said, we need to shut down the Alberta tar sands industry as quickly as possible, and we need to see large-scale direct actions to make that happen. The most effective remedy for fear is direct action. William Burnham. When you can't make up your mind which two evenly balanced courses of action you should take, choose the bolder. And finally, this is one of my favorites from Arundhati Roy. Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. So the question is, what are you willing to do? That's it.
So we're just going to have a quick 10 to 15 minute break. There's refreshments around the wall that you guys are all sitting in front of. And so please go help yourselves and feel free to talk and mingle. And then we're going to come back for questions afterwards. So, and I'll make an announcement, so don't feel that you have to, like, watch your clock or anything like that. Thank you.